Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. The Sea of Cortez is one of the most biologically diverse bodies of water on Earth. It is home to an incredible number of fish, sharks, dolphins, sea lions, a variety of rays, lobsters, sardines, and so many other creatures. Some only found in the 700-mile stretch of water that is wedged between the Mexico mainland and the Baja California Peninsula. But in the 1990s, the Mexican government began issuing shark fishing permits, which allowed multinational fleets, including Chinese and Japanese fishing boats, to strip mine critical habitats. And of course, we're talking about very large boats. They also strip mined nurseries, and this has led to a sharp decline in the population of sharks in the Sea of Cortez. It's also devastated local economies that relied on ecotourism and diving tours. The new documentary, Sharks of the Sea of Cortez, A Lost Treasure, looks back at the impacts of overfishing on the marine ecosystem and local economies and focuses on what is being done to protect this unique ecosystem. Joining us to talk about this film and what it will take to save the oceans and underwater life are three guests. Dr. James Ketchum is director of the documentary Sharks of the Sea of Cortez, A Lost Treasure, and director of marine conservation, lead scientist, and co-founder of Pelahi Oska Kunha, a nonprofit whose mission is to study and protect sharks and mantas in Mexico. Dr. James Ketchum has studied sharks since 1998. Hi, James. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, how are you? Good morning. Very glad to be here.
Did I get the name of your nonprofit right?
Yes, you did. You did good.
Great.
Difficult name.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're also joined by Alfredo Barroso, an award-winning underwater cameraman with over 30 years' experience of underwater filming. Alfredo is an expert on natural history and animal behavior and has filmed for a number of incredible series, including BBC Shark and Blue Planet 2. Originally from Cuba, he started exploring the coral reefs on Havana since his childhood. He now lives in Baja, California. Hi, Alfredo. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having us. Yes.
It's great to have you. And Lisa Uti is an underwater camera operator, underwater light operator, and a safety diver who works for wildlife documentaries about the oceans. Her recent credits include BBC's Blue Planet 2 and National Geographic's Perpetual Planet. A native from Finland, Lisa Uti also lives in Baja, California. Hi, Lisa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us to your program, Rose.
Well, it's great to have all of you. Thank you for making this really important, beautiful documentary. Before we dive in and talk about all of the issues that you raise, James, can you first tell us about the Sea of Cortez, which is wedged between the Mexico mainland and the Baja California Peninsula? Tell us more about its ecosystem.
Yeah, the Sea of Cortez, also known as the Gulf of California, it's a 1,000-mile-long stretch of water that's placed between the Baja California Peninsula and the mainland of Mexico. So it is an enclosed sea that connects to the Mexican Pacific. And because of its length and also because of where it lays in the latitude between the cold, temperate waters in the north to the tropical waters to the south, has a very diverse type of ecosystem from the cooler waters in the north, then you have, that's the upper Gulf, and has a very special conditions that they used to have the drainage of the Colorado River back in the day. I'm talking 56 years ago. Now it doesn't have that anymore. Mm. But because of that, the whole ecosystem in the northern upper Gulf has changed. And then we have the central Gulf, which is kind of transitional. It gets kind of cold, temperate, and then tropical in the summer. And then we have the southern Gulf, which is basically tropical, subtropical conditions. So we have a very diverse type of ecosystem right here in our backyard. I live in La Paz, and it's amazing to be here. It's very long, has a number of islands between La Paz all the way north, and these islands themselves hold their own ecosystems. And also the productivity of the Gulf of California is very, very important. It's a highly productive sea that sustains all of the marine life that you can see here in the Gulf of California. Also, is very deep. The upper Gulf is shallow, but the central to the southern Gulf, it's deep as 3,000 meters, almost 10,000 feet deep. And there's these places where there are trenches where you have this special ecosystem lying below. So you have incredible diversity of different types of ecosystems. We have also very extensive mangroves on the mainland side of the Gulf of California. Plus, you have a very wide platform, continental platform on that side. So that creates some of the most productive fisheries in the Mexican Pacific on the mainland side of the Baja Peninsula. On the Baja California side of Gulf California, the continental platform is very narrow, and it's dotted by a number of islands. So that creates, as I said, a special ecosystem full of life as well, but not as productive as the other side. And lastly, the mouth of the Gulf of California is very special because that's where the currents meet. We have the California Current that flows from Alaska down to Baja California, and that the mouth of the Gulf of California, that's where we have the meeting of the California Current conditions. It's cold water with the tropical currents that come from the south. So the mouth of Gulf of California is very special, highly productive as well, and that's where we have this array of different species and also a lot of migratory species that visit the Gulf of California in the winter, especially the larger whales. So I can keep on talking about Gulf of California, but this kind of summary of what we have here.
And the footage in the film is just so incredible. Alfredo, we learned that up until the 1990s, La Paz was one of the most popular diving spots in the world. Divers came from all over the world to experience this magical place. There were about hundreds of divers every day. So tell us a little bit about this. I mean, you would see hammerheads on every single dive?
Yeah, actually, I came here as a dive master. When I came, James used to be dive master as well. That's how we met. I came here precisely because I wanted to see hammerheads. And the first time I went to the El Bajo Sea Mount, which was the main place for hammerheads, and I just dropped into the middle of a river of hammerheads. I still talk about it right now. I have goosebumps. Mm. And because these were many sharks, and they were very big. They were small too, but I remember mainly all this river of big, big hammerheads. It was so beautiful. We used to take kids, you know, snorkeling. We grab the kids by the hand and show them a whirlwind of hammerheads just right there in 6 meters of water. It was really, really beautiful. It was very impressive, yes.
What is it like to be in the water with so many hammerheads? They're such incredible creatures. And for listeners, if you're not familiar, be sure to just search for images and hammerheads because they're just amazing to look at.
Yes, it is a little bit indescribable, no? Because the sensation of the emotions you have of being in the middle of a school of so many animals, big size animals, you know, they are so proudly swimming there, and it's so, I don't know, it's like three-dimensional, and it is, you feel the energy of I mean, there is, it's like a happy energy when you are in nature with this amount of animals. No, it's a difficult emotion to describe, but I can tell it's very special, it's very powerful. It fills your heart with some kind of joy and amazement and reverence. It's really, really, it's an emotion that we seek as much as we can because you get addicted to such a powerful thing, you know, such a powerful emotion.
Wow. What about you, Lisa? What brought you to Baja California? And what can you tell us about just how special this place is?
Well, actually, what brought me a little more than 7 years ago was the whales. I used to work in a whale camp, and then we soon got to know with Alfredo and started working together, and that's how I started to work in the ocean. And it's a truly special place. I mean, I obviously got to know it much later than James and Alfredo, and I get amazed by the marine life in its every single day. So, which is called the shifting baseline, actually, that the newcomers kind of have an idea that it's there's plenty of marine life where actually, you know, the fish populations have declined and other species populations have declined. But it's a truly special, beautiful place, and, you know, we really need to protect it.
Right. You know, what's amazing about your film, James, what's happening in the Sea of Cortez is happening in so many other parts of the world. We've done a lot of shows about underwater life. We've had people from Sea Shepherd on talking about the incredible work they do around the world. Can you just talk about that before we dive in and talk about the specifics of what's happening in the Sea of Cortez?
Yes, of course. Yeah, this is a worldwide thing. It's not only here in the Gulf of California or Sea of Cortez where this kind of thing, the decline of fish and sharks is happening. It's a worldwide problem. And because it's a worldwide problem, we have to think big, you know, in order to resolve this problem. And also because the animals move. Some of these species are highly migratory. So if you solve the problem in a very small MPA, for example, you're not solving the problem for the animals that are living or migrating from the MPA where they're protected to other places which are unprotected. And that happens right here in the Gulf of California. So, and still talking globally, there are now, fortunately, different groups, different NGOs, and also institutions are working hard to get the word out, because there's people that really don't know that this is happening to our oceans. Our oceans are being decimated worldwide. And because it's the main problem is the overfishing. So overfishing has to do with go over and take as much as you can, because somebody else is going to come over and take it. So we have to be careful with that. And we're not back in 30, 40 years ago when still fish were plentiful. And now in many different places, we can see how these places, such as the Sea of Cortez or Gulf of California, have been degraded. Although this was one of the last places very isolated and protected by its isolation, it is now decimated. So we have to work hard to recover this place.
Alfredo, you have so many amazing photos and footage on your Instagram account. How lucky are you to get so close to these incredible, incredible creatures? And, you know, I'm guessing the overwhelming majority of the population really doesn't go underwater to see these amazing creatures. But thanks to people like you and Lisa, we're able to see this through Blue Planet and through this documentary, Sharks of the Sea of Cortez, A Lost Treasure. Can you talk about the power of filming what is happening underwater to let people know that we really need to take action and protect these incredible creatures?
Yeah, I mean, images speak more than words, as they say, you know. And I mean, I became someone that interested about nature and about what I do, and I participate in conservation efforts because I like it. What I used to see when I was a kid in pictures from National Geographic magazines and in documentaries, and I said, man, I want to see that, no? And when people are, I mean, people like me, at least, that are confronted with something, I mean, they see an image of something they want to see, they will want to protect it. Others that can understand what happens when the ecosystem is full, what role each animal plays in an ecosystem, they will want, I mean, once people understand how nature works and what that brings to all of us and how everything is connected, they will be more willing to protect, no? And this is why it is important to do this kind of documentaries like the BBC series, and because some people will want to protect it just because they want to see it, others because they understand the need to have it. And because of what they do, I mean, what the animals and the ecosystem do to the well-being of the world and in consequence of us.
And what would you add, Lisa, about the power of showing underwater life to such a large audience through the films that you work on, including the one we're talking about today, Sharks of the Sea of Cortez?
Well, we as camera operators, we are really communicators, and what we through the natural history documentaries, we want to reveal, obviously, the beauty of the ocean life and the animal behavior and ultimately, you know, create knowledge and some sort of a connection with humans and animals and understanding what the animals are for and what's the whole connection there. But, I mean, these days, I think it's really important also to address the challenges that we are facing and, you know, the how the oceans are really doing. It's not an easy task to do, and we also go through all kinds of emotions underwater because you really get to see the maximum beauty of it and then also the dark side of it. So I think it's more important than ever, you know, to address these issues.
Right. And I mean, you're documenting major change because if you've spent enough time in one place, you can see major changes just over the course of 5 years, a couple years, really.
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
But, you know, at the same time, there are some positive changes because and maybe we're going to talk about it at some point, but that we have some protected area here relatively close to La Paz, and you can see how quickly nature can recover. In the images that we do in those locations, you can see the difference very quickly between this place that is protected, that have even a lot of sharks, resident sharks, they don't migrate, but the amount of fish, the size of the fish. So, I mean, this the difference between diving a protected area between so outside of it is, I mean, it's an incredible difference, no? And this sea is very generous and can recover if you give it the chance. So we are hoping that with this documentary, you know, that some change can happen, no? That, yeah.
This is such an important point. James, can you also talk about that? We learn more about the marine protected areas in the Sea of Cortez, and we've done shows about MPAs. The thing is, obviously, they need funding and there needs to be enforcement. And when you do have that and you leave the area alone, can you talk about how quickly things improve?
Yeah, that is a very important question because there's always a talk that MPAs are good and bad. No, it's like you either love them or you hate them. And the reality is that in places like the Gulf of California, Sofredo just pointed out that when you protect a very specific area, you get good results. That doesn't necessarily happen all over the place, all over the world, but here in the Gulf of California, because of its productivity, and as already said, this diverse ecosystem that you have here, you are able to get things back, recover things. So one good example is Cabo Pulmo. Cabo Pulmo was an unprotected place. I went there when it was totally unprotected and there were no sharks in the late 80s, early 90s. I never saw a shark. And then the park was created in 95. And nothing really changed drastically until 10 years later, in 2005, 10 years after the creation of the park, sharks returned. Wow. So then we have bull sharks returning, tiger sharks returning, and other species that you wouldn't see 5 or 10 years before. So that's a good example that if you give enough time, and in this case was 10 years, you can recover things. And 10 years sounds like a lot of time, but in terms of ecological processes, it's a very short period of time. So the recovery of this MPA in Cabo Pulmo was very quick because it's a no-take zone, and that's what it takes. And in cases where you protect, where you have MPAs, there are multi-use MPAs, the protection is not complete. And in those cases, the success is not as good as when you have no takes. That's what I'm trying to say. So in the case of Cabo Pulmo, because it's a no take, most of it, has been a very successful MPA. And so that we have an example here in the Gulf of California that we can do it. So the thing is to create more MPAs here in the Gulf of California.
Today we're talking about the new documentary Sharks of the Sea of Cortez, A Lost Treasure. Dr. James Ketchum is director of Sharks of the Sea of Cortez. We're also joined by Alfredo Barrasso and Lisa Uti. They are both underwater camera operators and have worked on a number of incredible series, including Blue Planet 2. Well, it's so interesting how fast these incredible ecosystems could be negatively affected by these multinational fleets that basically strip mine critical habitats, and then how fast they can come back if we just protect them with funding and enforcement. So as we said, up until the 1990s, La Paz was an amazing spot. Divers would come from all over the world. You were guaranteed to see hammerheads on every dive, surrounded by underwater life. And then the Mexican government decided to give out permits for fishing sharks, basically killing sharks, I mean, which is absolutely devastating. James, why did the Mexican government decide to do this?
Yeah, the reason is not a very, I don't have like a direct answer for that. I know that back then, and this is coming from even before, from the 80s, when the government was very focused on the fisheries. I mean, the fisheries were very, and still are, one of the main topics for the government to cover, to support. And back then, I'm talking 30, 40 years ago, it was one of the main projects of the government to direct a lot of the effort to get all those resources from the Gulf of California, which were very plentiful. They were directing all their efforts. But the Mexican government didn't have a fleet to do that. So at the time, especially in the 1980s, the Asian fleets, they did have the boats and the big boats and all the technical aspects to do it. There was like a talk, possibly, that's a part I'm not really aware of, but at some point in the 80s, this Asian boat started coming into the Mexican Pacific and exploiting these waters that the Mexican government or the Mexican fleets were unable, because we didn't have the boats to do it. So it was basically a concession. The Mexican government gave concessions to different boats and different companies coming from Asia, Korea, Japan, Chinese as well. And these big boats came in to fish basically whatever they wanted to. And the concession was like 49% cod for them and 51% cod for the Mexican government. So a ton of money was made back mm-hmm. then, but also had great, great devastating effects in the Gulf of California. 10 years, only 10 or 15 years after that, very, very intense fishing, especially in the 80s. So what we saw in the 90s was an effect of the 80s that was a cumulative effect of the overfishing during the 80s.
And it was incredible to learn, Alfredo, that in some cases, 5 to 6 years of overfishing is all it takes and can completely change the ecosystem.
Yes. I saw the change, and it was very, very sad. I used to go diving at that place that I mentioned before, El Bajo, and then, you know, sharks started to become scarce. And I remember the last time I saw them, I was kneeling in the bottom, watching them pass around me, some big ones, some small ones. And it was a contradictory feelings inside me. I was utterly happy, and at the same time, it looks dramatic, but I felt almost like crying, no? Mm. Because I said, these animals that are giving me so much joy and happiness right now might be killed tonight. And eventually, it became so bad that I haven't been back in El Bajo for more than 10 years, because wow. that used to be my favorite dive site in Baja, no? And I haven't been there for more than 10 years. I said, no, I would not come back until there is either protection or I can see these animals, you know, passing over me and around me, because it is heartbreaking. It is, that place used to be not only for sharks, but the schools of tuna, huge schools of snappers. It was, you could get lost, lose your way, because you couldn't see beyond the fish, no? We had to pass through huge schools of tuna, and after that is you have some space to find the sharks, no? It was amazing, and it became like a solitary rock in the middle of the ocean. It was like, it's sad, you know? And yeah, I mean, thankfully there are people like James that are making efforts to bring this life back to that place.
And Lisa, before we go to break, it's just so important to emphasize the fact that, as someone in the film said, a sea without sharks is not healthy. Sharks are an apex predator. They control the ecosystem in a top-down way. And once they're removed, the entire ecosystem is drastically changed.
Yes, I mean, we often, actually, we wanted to emphasize in the documentary both sides. You know, it's like the wolves in the nature. It's obvious if you take the main predator away, it affects all the rest of the ecosystem. That's one thing. But then the other thing is that it also brings benefits both for fishermen and both for the tourism. And so we wanted to bring these two aspects into, with the people. And actually, we are seeing some positive, very positive change in where we work a lot with the local communities and local fishermen, and luckily, since it's become a popular thing to go with the sharks and dive with the sharks, there's more demand, and also there, so these same fishermen now have a chance also, some of them, to bring people to swim with the sharks. So that's something that is happening at the local level, which is very exciting.
Right. It was amazing to actually meet fishermen who have killed sharks in the past, and now they realize just how important it is to ensure that sharks live. Because when you're thinking about the livelihoods of people, which is obviously important, you make a lot of money by taking people on trips with sharks. And so that was pretty incredible to meet those fishermen. We're going to take a quick break. Today we're talking about a new documentary, Sharks of the Sea of Cortez, A Lost Treasure. It looks back at the impacts of overfishing on the marine ecosystem and local economies, and also focuses on what's being done to protect this incredible ecosystem. Watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about a new documentary called Sharks of the Sea of Cortez. 30 years ago, swirling schools of hammerheads and giant manta rays made the Sea of Cortez a global diving mecca. But in the 90s, the Mexican government issued shark fishing permits, allowing multinational fleets to basically strip mine them in critical habitats. And this triggered a cascade of collapse among shark populations. Today, scientists and fishermen are working closely to restore and protect this incredible marine ecosystem. Today, we're joined by Dr. James Ketchum, director of Sharks of the Sea of Cortez. He has studied sharks since 1998. Alfredo Barroso is an award-winning underwater cameraman with over 30 years of experience underwater. He's an expert on natural history and animal behavior. Lisa Uti is an underwater camera operator, underwater light operator, and safety diver who works for wildlife documentaries about oceans. James, as I said before the break, it was really interesting to meet fishermen who were involved in killing sharks, and then they realized the value of ensuring that sharks are alive, because when it comes to local economies, you can make, obviously, so much more money when these creatures are alive and you can take people out to actually meet them. So can you talk about, you know, what it was like to meet these fishermen and hear these stories?
Yeah, this is a very important aspect of trying to do conservation. When we started working with the sharks, we tag sharks here in Gulf California. We place transmitters, so in order to understand how they move, how they dive, all their behavioral and ecology of these different animals, different species. We started working with a number of fishermen here in the Gulf of California, and some of them at the beginning were good and they liked the idea, but some of them were very afraid, you may say. They were not very accessible in terms of trying to talk to them and to work with them, because they didn't like, or some of them still don't, they still do, marine biologists. So because they are afraid that we're going to come over and start talking about closing down the fisheries and what they do and stuff like that. So it was kind of answering your question, it was a process that we have to go into, because the only way to be able to protect and to conserve these places in the Gulf of California is to work with the local community. That's the only way. This whole idea of creating MPAs and more MPAs in Gulf of California has to be hand in hand with the local communities, and specifically the local fishermen. So working with the artisanal fishers has been a pleasure, actually, because we can learn that they're, at the end, they're really interested in conservation. Although that word doesn't really ring nicely at the beginning, but at the end, they start understanding that if they don't protect themselves, what they use, what they have, everything is going to be gone quickly. So this is a very important process, and we live that with the fishermen in Espiritu Santo Island. And at the beginning, they didn't like the idea that we were going to be there trying to tag sharks. And now they're very happy to work with us. They love the tagging. They love the process of the science. They want to learn more. And now they tell me all the time, we're not going to fish more for sharks. And we like sharks to be alive, but we want to live, still get an income. Right. And that's when it gets tricky. You need to find a way that they get an income from the sharks, although they're not fishing for the sharks, but they need to get an income. So there are both ways we're working with them. One way is giving them a job to help us with the tagging. So they're actually fishing for the sharks. Then we tag them and we release them alive. And the other way is to provide an opportunity to them become tour operators, so they can take people to see the sharks. But that's a process that takes some time, because you need to adapt their boats, you need to convert their attitude and also their activity into a tourism activity. But I see a good opportunity, an incredible opportunity right now to work with some of these fishermen so they can become the tour operators themselves, and they get the direct benefit of this possible new MPAs here in the Gulf of California.
This is so, so important. Alfredo, can you talk about the interactions you've had with locals and what you're hearing from them about these issues? Because they get hit the hardest when it comes to the climate crisis, overfishing, and the locals need to feed their families. And oftentimes these large NGOs come in and say, this is what needs to happen. We need to protect these places. And the locals often feel like they're not part of the conversation. So can you talk more about that?
Yeah, when Lisa and me go to dive for either for fun or for work, most of the time we go with a local fisherman. And yeah, they talk a lot about their problems and the mistrust from governmental organizations or NGOs, because sometimes work haven't been done properly. Actually, I work with James because I like the way we work with him, because we like the way Pelagios, you know, work with the fishermen. And yeah, they are actually very worried about what's happening. You know, they know that something has to happen. Some change has to be, some big change, no? They don't know exactly how to organize themselves. They have to deal with industrial fishing is their biggest, concern. We act as intermediaries, sometimes like softening the way for, let's say, we are trying to bring James now to one of the locations we go diving, because they are really, really, they don't like biologists. That's the word they use for anybody that you know try to do conservation. But we're trying to soften in the way so James comes and work with them, and they are starting to open up and have more willingness to see what James has to offer and say. You know. Mm. Yeah.
Lisa, anything to add?
Yeah, it's. Definitely, it's not an easy process for you know the transition from a fisherman to become a tour operator. It must sound it's totally new for them. You know, they need to have an appropriate boat. They need to sort of learn the whole concept of customer service and you know the language. If they have foreign, it's not an easy thing to do. And also, they need to have the customers. You know, and so. We've been always like trying to encourage them and empower them and bringing people in and saying, you can actually, instead of killing these cute rays, you can take people to swim with them, and look, in 3 hours you make the same money that you would be doing in 1 week or something. So this is like very, very small scale efforts, but it's very interesting because you can see a change in them, and but in the end we are all in the same situation. We are all in the same planet. We are all facing the same challenges. So we must find solutions that are good for everybody.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show. Thanks for holding.
Hi, Rose and James and Alfredo and Lisa. I really appreciate the work that you're doing to help one save the ecology in the Sea of Cortez and the sharks and the fisher people. But this is just a different kind of question. The hammerheads, how did they evolve? I mean, why do they exist? I mean, with the funny looking eyes and things like that. How come they still exist?
I'm so glad you asked this. Let's spend some time
talking. It's kind of like Marty Feldman, the Marty Feldman of the sharks.
James, do you want to take that one first?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And we always get asked that question because as you said, it's a funny-looking animal. And why the hell they have this incredible shape and so forth? So, I mean, the reason is that, and it's really incredible that some species are very specialized, such as the scalloped hammerhead or any other hammerheads. There are 9 species, by the way. They have subsisted. And the thing is that evolution of that shape has provided the hammerheads, all the different species, an advantage compared to other species. Because what most sharks, actually all of the sharks have, and also the rays, underneath the mouth, in the underside, they have this very tiny pores that they lead to a sensor. They're called the ampulla of Lorenzini. And this ampulla are very sensitive to electrical fields. And because the hammerhead has a wider head, so if they have a wider surface area to detect this electric fields. And electric fields, you would say, why is that important? An electric field is formed by the contraction of the muscles from any animal, including ourselves. When you contract a muscle, you generate an electric field. So when these animals are looking for their prey, they're actually sensing with their head the bottom to find, for example, the rays are underneath the sand. They're hiding under the sand. And the rays say, no, you're not going to hide. I'm going to find you because I have this very special, it's kind of like a sonar, but it's not. It senses electrical fields. And the other advantage is navigation. They can even sense electromagnetic fields coming out from the rocks, from the volcanic rock that erupted from the bottom of the ocean. This creates like rivers of lava or volcanic rock lying in the bottom of the ocean and create this like swimways that this animal follow, feeling this electromagnetic fields moving from the resting areas, like in the seamounts, to the feeding grounds and back. It's like a highway that they use using these specialized organs. So that's why the hammerheads have been surviving through the ages, because they have an advantage. And that's why they have that. That head has been selected for, if we put it in more Darwinian terms.
Wow. Amazing. Do you have any other facts or information you'd like to share about hammerheads, Alfredo?
No, what I wanted to say is that when you see a picture of them, my first sensation when I saw a picture of a hammerhead, you think they are ugly animals, but in fact, when you see them in real life, they are super beautiful. It is a different thing when you see it in a picture than when you see them in real life, no? And it's a really, really beautiful animal. That's just what I was going to say. Because, I mean, James talked about all the evolutionary details, no? But just that detail, yeah.
You know, I also wanted to ask you, Alfredo and Lisa, since you're both underwater camera operators, and I love the Blue Planet series. All there's so many amazing series out there. And it's just the footage that you get, how close you get to these animals. I'm absolutely astounded when I watch these series. Lisa, can you talk more about this? About just what it takes to get these shots, how much time you spend. I mean, first of all, getting ready with all of your equipment, and then underwater. I love snorkeling, and sometimes after a minute of being underwater, you'll see something amazing, but on the next trip, it might take 30 minutes or an hour. So can you just talk about what is involved in getting such incredible footage?
Yeah, well, first of all, it takes a lot of research first, you know, regarding the animal, what sort of conditions and depth and what's the animal behavior and what times of the day do they appear, and like a lot of research, and then planning according to that research. You choose the right tool. For instance, we use quite often rebreathers, which is a specific gear that allows you, first of all, it allows you to be underwater up to 4 or 5 hours, depending on the model, and you don't produce any bubbles, so that makes the animals, you know, come closer to you, and it's a very organic silence way of being underwater, and it really does make a difference. But yeah, often it takes a lot of time, a lot of preparation. Depending on which subject you film, you might need just hours of you know, setting up tripods on the bottom, or and often just searching the animal. That's becoming more and more challenging nowadays. You know, you might end up you know, for days or even weeks just searching for the animal.
Wow. What would you add, Alfredo? I almost feel like the bar is so high at this point because these series are so amazing that we're almost expecting, you know, such incredible footage. What is involved? What would you add?
Yeah, I would say that a lot of it is also perseverance, coming from the part of the cameraman. Of course, resources to put us in the right location, not to bring us to the right location, but it is a lot of perseverance. Of course, there is all the experience that we have had dealing with animals and reading the animals. And when I say reading the animals, it's you have to think, where are you going to be, how are you going to act, how to position yourself, and then just staying there. Because sometimes it seems like a glamorous job, which is absolutely easy. It's the best thing ever invented as a job. But you do sometimes have we spend days and days in the water, nothing happens, you can get cold, and there is wave, and you get sunburn, and the time when there is nothing, it's very disheartening. You know, you spend days and days and you get nothing. I mean, you can spend 2 weeks out there, see nothing, and then suddenly, in a matter of an hour, you get all the shots that you needed, no? But it took a lot of time, resources, and time spent there, energy, in order to for that little half an hour or an hour to happen, and then the magic happens. No, you see things that are so rare, and it's a privilege. It's things that we will never forget. No, you need a lot of perseverance, experience, effort, and resources.
Wow. Well, incredible. We just saw a social media post of you surrounded by so much equipment getting ready for another project. I mean, at least 5-10 boxes, tons of bags. I mean, it really isn't. There's so much involved in this.
Yeah.
Traveling lights.
Right. It's a masochistic pleasure to be in the airport with 10, 12 boxes.
Wow, well, really incredible work. We have a couple of emails. Mary writes, over the last 30-plus years on whale-watching cruises in the Gulf of California, I've witnessed its many changes. This exceptionally rich and resilient body of water will only become less so the longer we wait to protect it. Only political will and decisive, effective action taken immediately will protect sharks and the ecosystem. Otherwise, Mexico will lose both an integral part of its natural heritage and a sustainable source of revenue. James, you talked earlier about marine protected areas. What is the status today if some of these massive fishing boats want licenses to kill sharks. Can they still get these licenses?
Yeah, they still can. And I understand that right now the government has closed down the new, offering new licenses or issuing new licenses. But the ones they already have, they have it almost for life. So some of the, like recently there was a tuna boat coming into the here near El Bajo Espiritu Santo 2 weeks ago. And we were like really hysterical because this boat is going to go over to El Bajo and all what's left, they're going to take it out. So they can actually fish in many other places in the Gulf of California because most of the Gulf of California is unprotected. And a lot of these islands, or if not all of them, a very small percentage are protected. And it's really easy. I mean, you go there and there's nobody there to do any surveillance. Even though there's some measures right now, there's a shark fishing ban that started 9 years ago in 2012, and that prohibits shark fishing in the Mexican waters, Mexican Pacific, I'm sorry. And that has helped. It's a shark fishing ban. It's a three-month ban that starts in May, so it's May, June, July. And right now we're at the end of this ban that happens every year. But we've seen every year a little more. So there's a positive story of this, the whole thing, that we see a little more sharks every year. Like this year, we're seeing a very good abundance of silky sharks in many places, including the famous El Bajo Espiritu Santo. So we see some small signs of recovery, and that makes you to be optimistic. So what we do need is to have more tools, more conservation tools in place. So this shark fishing ban by itself is not going to do the work. So we need to include the creation of more NPAs here in the Gulf of California.
Yes, that's great, great news. We're almost out of time, and I wonder if you can just quickly answer this question from Hector, who says there's a boom in construction and tourist developments in a region with a fragile ecosystem. In a country where tourism is the second source of income, how is development aligned with sustainability and conservation? Do you want to take that quickly, Alfredo?
Well, yeah, that's a big problem, and a little bit our documentary was aiming to this kind of developer to at least if they could see an advantage on creating protection for the sharks because it makes money, you know. But it's true that many of these hotels are being put in mangrove forest and in places that are ecologically sensitive, and that shouldn't be done. Like, this is very difficult. It's a very difficult problem we're having with the development. And thankfully, there are people trying to conservation organizations trying to work on that. I think there are some trying to address that problem. But yeah, development could be a help, but there is a lot of damage they do.
Right. And also, it's such a tough one because the locals need the tourism and people want to see these beautiful places. But then what's the best way to be a tourist? I mean, that's a never ending question. In fact, Mita writes that she's gone to Mexico for several years on a vacation and she finally went snorkeling and had an incredible experience. Lisa, final thoughts. Is there anything you'd like to say about what does it take to be a tourist and to be a responsible tourist? And what can you do to raise your voice to ensure that the local government is really, making the right choices around these issues?
Well, first of all, I think, I wish people wouldn't get indifferent, you know, in general. We need to sort of bear to see the challenges we are facing with the oceans and then get involved, you know, get involved in initiatives related to ocean conservation, the diet we are eating, you can sign petitions, and then get in the ocean and get to know these amazing animals and use local tour operators to do it. And that's, you can make a big difference. An individual can make a huge difference.
Lisa Uti is an underwater camera operator, underwater light operator, and safety diver who works for wildlife documentaries about oceans. Alfredo Barroso is an award-winning underwater cameraman with over 30 years of experience underwater. And Dr. James Ketchum is director of the new documentary, Sharks of the Sea of Cortez. You can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. James, Alfredo, and Lisa, thank you so much for all the great work you do. And thank you for this incredible documentary.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your Calls One Planet series.